Blackstone Audio presents I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. To Henry Kuttner, with my grateful thanks for his help and encouragement on this book. Part 1, January 1976. Chapter 1. On those cloudy days, Robert Neville was never sure when sunset came, and sometimes they were in the streets before he could get back. If he had been more analytical, he might have calculated the approximate time of their arrival, but he still used the lifetime habit of judging nightfall by the sky, and on cloudy days that method didn't work. That was why he chose to stay near the house on those days. He walked around the house in the dull gray of afternoon, a cigarette dangling from the corner of his mouth, trailing thread-like smoke over his shoulder. He checked each window to see if any of the boards had been loosened. After violent attacks, the planks were often split or partially pried off, and he had to replace them completely, a job he hated. Today, only one plank was loose. Isn't that amazing? He thought. In the backyard, he checked the hothouse and the water tank. Sometimes the structure around the tank might be weakened or its rain catchers bent or broken off. Sometimes they would lob rocks over the high fence around the hothouse, and occasionally they would tear through the overhead net, and he'd have to replace panes. Both the tank and the hothouse were undamaged today. He went to the house for a hammer and nails. As he pushed open the front door, he looked at the distorted reflection of himself in the cracked mirror he'd fastened to the door a month ago. In a few days, jagged pieces of the silver-backed glass would start to fall off. Let them fall, he thought. It was the last damned mirror he'd put there. It wasn't worth it. He'd put garlic there instead. Garlic always worked. He passed slowly through the dim silence of the living room, turned left into the small hallway, and left again into his bedroom. Once the room had been warmly decorated, but that was in another time. Now it was a room entirely functional, and since Neville's bed and bureau took up so little space, he had converted one side of the room into a shop. A long bench covered almost an entire wall. On its hardwood top, a heavy bandsaw, a wood lathe, an emery wheel, and a vise. Above it, on the wall, were haphazard racks of the tools that Robert Neville used. He took a hammer from the bench and picked out a few nails from one of the disordered bins. Then he went back outside and nailed the plank fast to the shutter. The unused nails he threw into the rubble next door. For a while he stood on the front lawn, looking up and down the silent length of Cimarron Street. He was a tall man, 36, born of English-German stock, his features undistinguished except for the long, determined mouth and the bright blue of his eyes, which moved now over the charred ruins of the houses on each side of his. He'd burned them down to prevent them from jumping on his roof from the adjacent ones. After a few minutes, he took a long, slow breath and went back into the house. He tossed the hammer on the living room couch, then lit another cigarette and had his mid-morning drink. Later, he forced himself into the kitchen to grind up the five-day accumulation of garbage in the sink. He knew he should burn up the paper plates and utensils, too, and dust the furniture and wash out the sinks and the bathtub and toilet, and changed the sheets and pillowcase on his bed, but he didn't feel like it. For he was a man, and he was alone, and these things had no importance to him. It was almost noon. Robert Neville was in his hothouse collecting a basketful of garlic. In the beginning, it had made him sick to smell garlic in such quantity. His stomach had been in a state of constant turmoil. Now the smell was in his house and in his clothes, and sometimes he thought it was even in his flesh. He hardly noticed it at all. When he had enough bulbs, he went back to the house and dumped them on the drainboard of the sink. As he flicked the wall switch, the light flickered, then flared into normal brilliance. A disgusted hiss passed his clenched teeth. The generator was at it again. He'd have to get out that damned manual again and check the wiring. And if it were too much trouble to repair, he'd have to install a new generator. Angrily, he jerked a high-legged stool to the sink, got a knife, and sat down with an exhausted grunt. First, he separated the bulbs into the small, sickle-shaped cloves. Then he cut each pink, leathery clove in half, exposing the fleshy center buds. The air thickened with the musty, pungent odor. When it got too oppressive, he snapped on the air conditioning unit, and suction drew away the worst of it. Now he reached over and took an ice pick from its wall rack. He punched holes in each clove half, then strung them all together with wire until he had about 25 necklaces. In the beginning, he had hung these necklaces over the windows, but from a distance they'd thrown rocks until he'd been forced to cover the broken panes with plywood scraps. Finally, one day, he'd torn off the plywood and nailed up even rows of planks instead. It had made the house a gloomy sepulcher, but it was better than having rocks come flying into his rooms in a shower of splintered glass. And once he had installed the three air conditioning units, it wasn't too bad. A man could get used to anything if he had to. When he was finished stringing the garlic cloves, he went outside and nailed them over the window boarding, taking down the old strings, which had lost most of their potent smell. He had to go through this process twice a week. Until he found something better, it was his first line of defense. Defense, he often thought. For what? All afternoon he made steaks. He lathed them out of thick doweling, band-sawed into 9-inch lengths. These he held against the whirling emery stone until they were as sharp as daggers. It was tiresome, monotonous work, and it filled the air with hot-smelling wood dust that settled in his pores and got into his lungs and made him cough. Yet he never seemed to get ahead. No matter how many steaks he made, they were gone in no time at all. Doweling was getting harder to find, too. Eventually, he'd have to lathe down rectangular lengths of wood. Won't that be fun? He thought irritably. It was all very depressing, and it made him resolve to find a better method of disposal. But how could he find it, when they never gave him a chance to slow down and think? As he lathed, he listened to records over the loudspeaker he'd set up in the bedroom, Beethoven's 3rd, 7th, and 9th symphonies. He was glad he'd learned early in life, from his mother, to appreciate this kind of music. It helped to fill the terrible void of hours. From 4 o'clock on, his gaze kept shifting to the clock on the wall. He worked in silence, lips pressed into a hard line, a cigarette in the corner of his mouth, his eyes staring at the bit as it gnawed away the wood and sent flowery dust filtering down to the floor. 4:15. 4:30. It was 4:45. In another hour, they'd be at the house again. The filthy bastards. As soon as the light was gone. He stood before the giant freezer, selecting his supper. His jaded eyes moved over the stacks of meats, down to the frozen vegetables, down to the breads and pastries, the fruits and ice cream. He picked out 2 lamb chops, string beans, and a small box of orange sherbet. He picked the boxes from the freezer and pushed shut the door with his elbow. Next, he moved over to the uneven stacks of cans piled to the ceiling. He took down a can of tomato juice, then left the room that had once belonged to Kathy, and now belonged to his stomach. He moved slowly across the living room, looking at the mural that covered the back wall. It showed a cliff edge, shearing off to green-blue ocean that surged and broke over black rocks. Far up in the clear blue sky, white seagulls floated on the wind, and over on the right, a gnarled tree hung over the precipice, its dark branches etched against the sky. Neville walked into the kitchen and dumped the groceries on the table, his eyes moving to the clock. 6:20. Soon now. He poured a little water into a small pan and clanked it down on a stove burner. Next, he thawed out the chops and put them under the broiler. By this time, the water was boiling, and he dropped in the frozen string beans and covered them, thinking that it was probably the electric stove that was milking the generator. At the table, he sliced himself 2 pieces of bread and poured himself a glass of tomato juice. He sat down and looked at the red second hand as it swept slowly around the clock face. The bastards ought to be here soon. After he'd finished his tomato juice, he walked to the front door and went out onto the porch. He stepped off onto the lawn and walked down to the sidewalk. The sky was darkening and it was getting chilly. He looked up and down Cimarron Street, the cool breeze ruffling his blonde hair. That's what was wrong with these cloudy days. You never knew when they were coming. Oh, well. At least they were better than those damn dust storms. With a shrug, he moved back across the lawn and into the house, locking and bolting the door behind him, sliding the thick bar into place. Then he went back into the kitchen, turned his chops, and switched off the heat under the string beans. He was putting the food on his plate when he stopped and his eyes moved quickly to the clock. 6:25 today. Ben Cortman was shouting.
Come out, Neville!
Robert Neville sat down with a sigh and began to eat. He sat in the living room trying to read. He'd made himself a whiskey and soda at his small bar, and he held the cold glass as he read a physiology text. From the speaker over the hallway door, the music of Schoenberg was playing loudly. Not loudly enough, though. He still heard them outside, their murmuring and their walkings about and their cries, their snarling and fighting among themselves. Once in a while, a rock or brick thudded off the house. Sometimes a dog barked. And they were all there for the same thing. Robert Neville closed his eyes a moment and held his lips in a tight line. Then he opened his eyes and lit another cigarette, letting the smoke go deep into his lungs. He wished he'd had time to soundproof the house. It wouldn't be so bad if it weren't that he had to listen to them. Even after 5 months, it got on his nerves. He never looked at them anymore. In the beginning, he'd made a peephole in the front window and watched them. But then the women had seen him and had started striking vile postures in order to entice him out of the house. He didn't want to look at that. He put down his book and stared bleakly at the rug, hearing Berklarternach play over the loudspeaker. He knew he could put plugs in his ears to shut off the sound of them, but that would shut off the music, too, and he didn't want to feel that they were forcing him into a shell. He closed his eyes again. It was the women who made it so difficult, he thought. The women posing like lewd puppets in the night on the possibility that he'd see them and decide to come out. A shudder ran through him. Every night it was the same. He'd be reading and listening to music. Then he'd start to think about soundproofing the house. Then he'd think about the women. Deep in his body, the knotting heat began again, and he pressed his lips together until they were white. He knew the feeling well, and it enraged him that he couldn't combat it. It grew and grew until he couldn't sit still anymore. Then he'd get up and pace the floor, fists bloodless at his sides. Maybe he'd set up the movie projector, or eat something, or have too much to drink, or turn the music up so loud it hurt his ears. He had to do something when it got really bad. He felt the muscles of his abdomen closing in, like tightening coils. He picked up the book and tried to read, his lips forming each word slowly and painfully. But in a moment, the book was on his lap again. He looked at the bookcase across from him. All the knowledge in those books couldn't put out the fires in him. All the words of centuries couldn't end the wordless, mindless craving of his flesh. The realization made him sick. It was an insult to a man. All right, it was a natural drive, but there was no outlet for it anymore. They'd forced celibacy on him. He'd have to live with it. "You have a mind, don't you?" he asked himself. "We'll use it." He reached over and turned the music still louder, then forced himself to read a whole page without pause. He read about blood cells being forced through membranes, about pale lymph carrying the wastes through tubes blocked by lymph nodes, about lymphocytes and phagocytic cells. To empty, in the left shoulder region, near the thorax, into a large vein of the blood circulating system. The book shut with a thud. Why didn't they leave him alone? Did they think they could all have him? Were they so stupid they thought that? Why did they keep coming every night? After 5 months, you'd think they'd give up and try elsewhere. He went over to the bar and made himself another drink. As he turned back to his chair, he heard stones rattling down across the roof and landing with thuds in the shrubbery beside the house. Above the noises, he heard Ben Cortman shout, as he always shouted, "Come out, Neville!" "Someday I'll get that bastard," he thought, as he took a big swallow of the bitter drink. "Someday I'll knock a stake right through his goddamn chest. I'll make one a foot long for him, a special one with ribbons on it. The bastard." Tomorrow, he'd soundproof the house. His fingers drew into white-knuckled fists. He couldn't stand thinking about those women. If he didn't hear them, maybe he wouldn't think about them. Tomorrow. The music ended, and he took a stack of records off the turntable and slid them back into their cardboard envelopes. Now he could hear them even more clearly outside. He reached for the first new record he could get and put it on the turntable and twisted the volume up to its highest point. "The Year of the Plague" by Roger Lee filled his ears. Violins scraped and whined, timpani thudded like the beats of a dying heart, flutes played weird, atonal melodies. With a stiffening of rage, he wrenched up the record and snapped it over his right knee. He'd meant to break it long ago. He walked on rigid legs to the kitchen and flung the pieces into the trash box. Then he stood in the dark kitchen, eyes tightly shut, teeth clenched, hands clamped over his ears. "Leave me alone. Leave me alone. Leave me alone." No use. You couldn't beat them at night. No use trying. It was their special time. He was acting very stupidly, trying to beat them. Should he watch a movie? No. He didn't feel like setting up a projector. He'd go to bed and put the plugs in his ears. It was what he ended up doing every night anyway. Quickly, trying not to think at all, he went to the bedroom and undressed. He put on pajama bottoms and went into the bathroom. He never wore pajama tops. It was a habit he'd acquired in Panama during the war. As he washed, he looked into the mirror at his broad chest, at the dark hair swirling around the nipples and down the center line of his chest. He looked at the ornate cross he'd had tattooed on his chest one night in Panama when he'd been drunk. "What a fool I was in those days," he thought. Well, maybe that cross had saved his life. He brushed his teeth carefully and used dental floss. He tried to take good care of his teeth because he was his own dentist now. Some things could go to pot, but not his health, he thought. "Then why don't you stop pouring alcohol into yourself?" he thought. "Why don't you shut the hell up?" he thought. Now he went through the house, turning out lights. For a few minutes, he looked at the mural and tried to believe it was really the ocean. But how could he believe it with all the bumpings and the scrapings, the howlings and snarlings and cries in the night? He turned off the living room lamp and went into the bedroom. He made a sound of disgust when he saw that sawdust covered the bed. He brushed it off with snapping hand strokes, thinking that he'd better build a partition between the shop and the sleeping portion of the room.
Better do this and better do that, he thought morosely. There were so many damned things to do, he'd never get to the real problem.
He jammed in his earplugs, and a great silence engulfed him. He turned off the light and crawled in between the sheets. He looked at the radium-faced clock and saw that it was only a few minutes past 10. Just as well, he thought. This way I'll get an early start. He lay there on the bed and took deep breaths of the darkness, hoping for sleep. But the silence didn't really help. He could still see them out there. The white-faced men prowling around his house, looking ceaselessly for a way to get in at him. Some of them, probably, crouching on their haunches like dogs, eyes glittering at the house, teeth slowly grating together, back and forth, and the women.
Did he have to start thinking about them again?
He tossed over on his stomach with a curse and pressed his face into the hot pillow. He lay there breathing heavily, body writhing slightly on the sheet.
Let the morning come.
His mind spoke the words it spoke every night.
Dear God, let the morning come.
He dreamed about Virginia, and he cried out in his sleep, and his fingers gripped the sheets like frenzied talons. Chapter 2 The alarm went off at 5:30, and Robert Neville reached out a numbed arm in the morning gloom and pushed in the stop. He reached for his cigarettes and lit one, then sat up. After a few moments, he got up and walked into the dark living room and opened the peephole door. Outside on the lawn, the dark figures stood like silent soldiers on duty. As he watched, some of them started moving away, and he heard them muttering discontentedly among themselves. Another night was ended. He went back to the bedroom, switched on the light, and dressed. As he was pulling on his shirt, he heard Ben Cortman cry out, "Come out, devil!" And that was all. After that, they all went away weaker, he knew, than when they had come. Unless they had attacked one of their own. They did that often. There was no union among them. Their need was their only motivation. After dressing, Neville sat down on his bed with a grunt and penciled his list for the day. Lathe at Sears. Water. Check generator. Dowling. Usual. Breakfast was hasty. A glass of orange juice, a slice of toast, and 2 cups of coffee. He finished it quickly, wishing he had the patience to eat slowly. After breakfast, he threw the paper plate and cup into the trash box and brushed his teeth. At least I have one good habit, he consoled himself. The first thing he did when he went outside was look at the sky. It was clear, virtually cloudless. He could go out today. Good. As he crossed the porch, his shoe kicked some pieces of the mirror. Well, the damn thing broke just as I thought it would, he thought. He'd clean it up later. One of the bodies was sprawled on the sidewalk. The other one was half concealed in the shrubbery. They were both women. They were almost always women. He unlocked the garage door and backed his Willis station wagon into the early morning crispness. Then he got out and pulled down the back gate. He put on heavy gloves and walked over to the woman on the sidewalk. There was certainly nothing attractive about them in the daylight, he thought, as he dragged them across the lawn and threw them up on the canvas tarpaulin. There wasn't a drop left in them. Both women were the color of fish out of water. He raised the gate and fastened it. He went around the lawn then, picking up stones and bricks and putting them into a cloth sack. He put the sack in the station wagon, and then took off his gloves. He went inside the house, washed his hands, and made lunch. 2 sandwiches, a few cookies, and a thermos of hot coffee. When that was done, he went into the bedroom and got his bag of steaks. He slung this across his back and buckled on the holster that held his mallet. Then he went out of the house, locking the front door behind him. He wouldn't bother searching for Ben Cortman that morning. There were too many other things to do. For a second, he thought about the soundproofing job he'd resolved to do on the house. Well, the hell with it, he thought. I'll do it tomorrow, or some cloudy day. He got into the station wagon and checked his list. Lathe at Sears, that was first. After he dumped the bodies, of course. He started the car and backed quickly into the street and headed for Compton Boulevard. There he turned right and headed east. On both sides of him, the houses stood silent, and against the curbs, cars were parked, empty and dead. Robert Neville's eyes shifted down for a moment to the fuel gauge. There was still a half tank, but he might as well stop on Western Avenue and fill it. There was no point in using any of the gasoline stored in the garage until he had to. He pulled into the silent station and braked. He got a barrel of gasoline and siphoned it into his tank until the pale amber fluid came gushing out of the tank opening and ran down onto the cement. He checked the oil, water, battery water, and tires. Everything was in good condition. It usually was, because he took special care of the car. If it ever broke down so that he couldn't get back to the house by sunset. Well, there was no point in even worrying about that. If it ever happened, that was the end. Now he continued up Compton Boulevard, past the tall oil derricks, through Compton, through all the silent streets. There was no one to be seen anywhere. But Robert Neville knew where they were. The fire was always burning. As the car drew closer, he pulled on his gloves and gas mask, and watched through the eyepieces the sooty pall of smoke hovering above the earth. The entire field had been excavated into one gigantic pit. That was in June 1975. Neville parked the car and jumped out, anxious to get the job over with quickly. Throwing the catch and jerking down the rear gate, he pulled out one of the bodies and dragged it to the edge of the pit. There he stood it on its feet and shoved. The body bumped and rolled down the steep incline until it settled on the great pile of smoldering ashes at the bottom. Robert Neville drew in harsh breaths as he hurried back to the station wagon. He always felt as though he were strangling when he was here, even though he had the gas mask on. Now he dragged the second body to the brink of the pit and pushed it over. Then, after tossing the sack of rocks down, he hurried back to the car and sped away. After he'd driven a half mile, he skinned off the mask and gloves and tossed them into the back. His mouth opened, and he drew in deep lungfuls of fresh air. He took the flask from the glove compartment and took a long drink of burning whiskey. Then he lit a cigarette and inhaled deeply. Sometimes he had to go to the burning pit every day for weeks at a time, and it always made him sick. Somewhere down there was Kathy. On the way to Inglewood, he stopped at a market to get some bottled water. As he entered the silent store, the smell of rotted food filled his nostrils. Quickly, he pushed a metal wagon up and down the silent, dust-thick aisles, the heavy smell of decay setting his teeth on edge, making him breathe through his mouth. He found the water bottles in back, and also found a door opening on a flight of stairs. After putting all the bottles into the wagon, he went up the stairs. The owner of the market might be up there. He might as well get started. There were two of them. In the living room, lying on a couch, was a woman about 30 years old, wearing a red housecoat. Her chest rose and fell slowly as she lay there, eyes closed, her hands clasped over her stomach. Robert Neville's hands fumbled on the stake and mallet. It was always hard when they were alive, especially with women. He could feel that senseless demand returning again, tightening his muscles. He forced it down. It was insane. There was no rational argument for it. She made no sound except for a sudden hoarse intake of breath. As he walked into the bedroom, he could hear a sound like the sound of water running.
Well, what else can I do? He asked himself, for he still had to convince himself he was doing the right thing.
He stood in the bedroom doorway, staring at the small bed by the window, his throat moving, breath shuddering in his chest. Then, driven on, he walked to the side of the bed and looked down at her.
Why do they all look like Kathy to me?
He thought, drawing out the second stake with shaking hands. Driving slowly to Sears, he tried to forget by wondering why it was that only wooden stakes should work. He frowned as he drove along the empty boulevard, the only sound the muted growling of the motor in his car. It seemed fantastic that it had taken him 5 months to start wondering about it. Which brought another question to mind. How was it that he always managed to hit the heart? It had to be the heart. Dr. Bush had said so. Yet he, Neville, had no anatomical knowledge. His brow furrowed. It irritated him that he should have gone through this hideous process so long without stopping once to question it. He shook his head. No. I should think it over carefully, he thought. I should collect all the questions before I try to answer them. Things should be done the right way, the scientific way.
Yeah, he thought. Shades of old Fritz.
That had been his father's name. Neville had loathed his father and fought the acquisition of his father's logic and mechanical facility every inch of the way. His father had died denying the vampire, violently, to the last. At Sears he got the lathe, loaded it into the station wagon, then searched the store. There were 5 of them in the basement, hiding in various shadowed places. One of them Neville found inside a display freezer. When he saw the man lying there in this enamel coffin, he had to laugh. It seemed such a funny place to hide. Later, he thought of what a humorless world it was when he could find amusement in such a thing. At about 2 o'clock, he parked and ate his lunch. Everything seemed to taste of garlic. And that set him wondering about the effect garlic had on them. It must have been the smell that chased them off, but why? They were strange, the facts about them. Their staying inside by day, their avoidance of garlic, their death by stake, their reputed fear of crosses, their supposed dread of mirrors. Take that last now. According to legend, they were invisible in mirrors. But he knew that was untrue. As untrue as the belief that they transformed themselves into bats. That was a superstition that logic plus observation had easily disposed of. It was equally foolish to believe that they could transform themselves into wolves. Without a doubt, there were vampire dogs. He had seen and heard them outside his house at night. But they were only dogs. Robert Neville compressed his lips suddenly. Forget it, he told himself. You're not ready yet. The time would come when he'd take a crack at it, detail for detail. But the time wasn't now. There were enough things to worry about now. After lunch, he went from house to house and used up all his stakes. He had 47 stakes. Chapter 3. The strength of the vampire is that no one will believe in him. Thank you, Dr. Van Helsing, he thought, putting down his copy of Dracula. He sat staring moodily at the bookcase, listening to Brahms' second piano concerto, a whiskey sour in his right hand, a cigarette between his lips. It was true. The book was a hodgepodge of superstitions and soap opera clichés, but that line was true. No one had believed in them. And how could they fight something they didn't even believe in? That was what the situation had been. Something black and of the night had come crawling out of the Middle Ages. Something with no framework or credulity. something that had been consigned, fact and figure, to the pages of imaginative literature. Vampires were passé, summer's idols or Stoker's melodramatics, or a brief inclusion in the Britannica, or grist for the pulp writer's mill, or raw material for the B-film factories. A tenuous legend passed from century to century.
Well, it was true. He took a sip from his drink and closed his eyes as the cold liquid trickled down his throat and warmed his stomach. True, he thought, but no one ever got the chance to know it. Oh, they knew it was something, but it couldn't be that. Not that. That was imagination. That was superstition. There was no such thing as that. And before science had caught up with the legend had swallowed science and everything. He hadn't found any Dowling that day. He hadn't checked the generator. He hadn't cleaned up the pieces of mirror. He hadn't eaten supper. He'd lost his appetite. That wasn't hard. He lost it most of the time. He couldn't do the things he'd done all afternoon and then come home to a hearty meal. Not even after 5 months. He thought of the 12 children that afternoon. And he finished his drink in 2 swallows. He blinked, and the room wavered a little before him. "You're getting blotto, Father," he told himself. "So what?" he returned. "Has anyone more right?" He tossed the book across the room. "Begone, Van Helsing, and Mina, and Jonathan, and Blood-Eyed Count, and all. All figments, all driveling extrapolations on a somber theme." A coughing chuckle emptied itself from his throat. Outside, Ben Cortman called for him to come out. "Be right out, Benny," he thought, "soon as I get my tuxedo on." He shuddered and gritted his teeth edges together. Be right out. Well, why not? Why not go out? It was a sure way to be free of them. Be one of them. He chuckled at the simplicity of it, then shoved himself up and walked crookedly to the bar. Why not? His mind plodded on. Why go through all this complexity when a flung-open door and a few steps would end it all? For the life of him, he didn't know. There was, of course, the faint possibility that others like him existed somewhere, trying to go on, hoping that someday they would be among their own kind again. But how could he ever find them if they weren't within a day's drive of his house? He shrugged and poured more whiskey in the glass. He'd given up the use of jiggers months ago. Garlic on the windows and nets over the hothouse and burn the bodies and cart the rocks away, and fraction of an inch by fraction of an inch reduce their unholy numbers. Why kid himself? He'd never find anyone else. His body dropped down heavily on the chair. Here we are, kiddies, sitting like a bug in a rug, snugly, surrounded by a battalion of bloodsuckers who wish no more than to sip freely of my bonded 100-proof hemoglobin. Have a drink, men. This one's really on me. His face twisted into an expression of raw, unqualified hatred. Bastards! I'll kill every mother's son of you before I'll give in. His right hand closed like a clamp, and the glass shattered in his grip. He looked down, dull-eyed, at the fragments on the floor, at the jagged piece of glass still in his hand, at the whiskey-diluted blood dripping off his palm. Wouldn't they like to get some of it, though? He thought. He started up with a furious lurch and almost opened the door so he could wave the hand in their faces and hear them howl. Then he closed his eyes, and a shudder ran through his body. Wise up, buddy, he thought. Go bandage your goddamn hand. He stumbled into the bathroom and washed his hand carefully,
gasping as he daubed iodine into the sliced open flesh. Then he bandaged it clumsily, his broad chest rising and falling with jerky movements, sweat dripping from his forehead. "I need a cigarette," he thought. In the living room again, he changed Brahms for Bernstein and lit a cigarette. "What will I do if I ever run out of coffin nails?" he wondered, looking at the cigarette's blue, trailing smoke. Well, there wasn't much chance of that. He had about 1,000 cartons in the closet of Kathy's. He clenched his teeth together. In the closet of the larder. The larder. The larder. Kathy's room. He sat staring with dead eyes at the mural, while the age of anxiety pulsed in his ears. "Age of anxiety," he mused. "You thought you had anxiety, Lenny boy. Lenny and Benny. You two should meet. Composer, meet corpse. Mama, when I grow up, I want to be a vampire like Dada." "Why, bless you, hon. Of course you shall." The whiskey gurgled into the glass. He grimaced a little at the pain in his hand and shifted the bottle to his left hand. He sat down and sipped. "Let the jagged edge of sobriety be now dulled," he thought. "Let the crumbly balance of clear vision be expunged, but post-haste. I hate 'em." Gradually, the room shifted on its gyroscopic center and wove and undulated about his chair. A pleasant haze, fuzzy at the edges, took over sight. He looked at the glass, at the record player. He let his head flop from side to side. Outside, they prowled and muttered and waited. "Poor vampires," he thought. "Poor little cusses, pussyfooting round my house, so thirsty, so all forlorn." A thought. He raised a forefinger that wavered before his eyes. "Friends, I come before you to discuss the vampire, a minority element if ever there was one, and there was one. But to concision, I will sketch out the basis for my thesis, which thesis is this. Vampires are prejudiced against. The keynote of minority prejudice is this. They are loathed because they are feared. Thus..." He made himself a drink. A long one. At one time, the Dark and Middle Ages, to be succinct, the vampire's power was great, the fear of him tremendous. He was anathema, and still remains anathema. Society hates him without ration. But are his needs any more shocking than the needs of other animals and men? Are his deeds more outrageous than the deeds of the parent who drained the spirit from his child? The vampire may foster quickened heartbeats and levitated hair, but is he worse than the parent who gave to society a neurotic child who became a politician? Is he worse than the manufacturer who set up belated foundations with the money he made by handing bombs and guns to suicidal nationalists? Is he worse than the distiller who gave bastardized grain juice to stultify further the brains of those who, sober, were incapable of a progressive thought? Nay, I apologize for this calumny. I nip the brew that feeds me. Is he worse, then, than the publisher who filled ubiquitous racks with lust and death wishes? Really, now, search your soul, lovey. Is the vampire so bad? All he does is drink blood. Why, then, this unkind prejudice, this thoughtless bias? Why cannot the vampire live where he chooses? Why must he seek out hiding places where none can find him out? Why do you wish him destroyed? Ah, see, you have turned the poor guileless innocent into a haunted animal. He has no means of support, no measures for proper education. He has not the voting franchise. No wonder he is compelled to seek out a predatory nocturnal existence. Robert Neville grunted a surly grunt. Sure, he thought.
But would you let your sister marry one?
He shrugged.
You got me there, buddy. You got me there.
The music ended. The needle scratched back and forth in the black grooves. He sat there, feeling a chill creeping up his legs. That's what was wrong with drinking too much. You became immune to drunken delights. There was no solace in liquor. Before you got happy, you collapsed.
Already the room was straightening out. The sounds outside were starting to nibble at his eardrums.
Come out, Neville.
His throat moved and a shaking breath passed his lips.
Come out.
The women were out there, their dresses open or taken off, their flesh waiting for his touch, their lips waiting for
my blood. My blood!
As if it were someone else's hand, he watched his whitened fist rise up slowly, shuddering, to drive down on his leg. The pain made him suck in a breath of the house's stale air. Garlic, everywhere the smell of garlic. In his clothes and in the furniture and in his food and even in his drink, have a garlic and soda. His mind rattled out the attempted joke. He lurched up and started pacing.
What am I going to do now?
Go through the routine again? I'll save you the trouble. Reading, drinking, soundproof the house, the women. The women, the lustful, bloodthirsty, naked women flaunting their hot bodies at him. No, not hot. A shuddering whine wrenched up through his chest and throat.
God damn them! What were they waiting for? Did they think he was going to come out and hand himself over?
Maybe I am. Maybe I am. He actually found himself jerking off the crossbar from the door.
Coming, girls. I'm coming. Wet your lips now.
Outside, they heard the bar being lifted, and a howl of anticipation sounded in the night. Spinning, he drove his fists one after the other into the wall until he'd cracked the plaster and broken his skin. Then he stood there, trembling helplessly, his teeth chattering. After a while it passed. He put the bar back across the door and went into the bedroom. He sank down on the bed and fell back on the pillow with a groan. His left hand beat once, feebly, on the bedspread.
Oh, God, he thought. How long? How long?
Chapter 4. The alarm never went off because he'd forgotten to set it. He slept soundly and motionlessly, his body like cast iron. When he finally opened his eyes, it was 10 o'clock. With a disgusted muttering, he struggled up and dropped his legs over the side of the bed. Instantly, his head began throbbing, as if his brains were trying to force their way through his skull.
Fine, he thought. A hangover. That's all I need.
He pushed himself up with a groan and stumbled into the bathroom, threw water in his face, and splashed some over his head.
No good, his mind complained. No good. I still feel like hell.
In the mirror, his face was gaunt, bearded, and very much like the face of a man in his 40s.
Love, your magic spell is everywhere.
Inanely, the words flapped across his brain like wet sheets in a wind. He walked slowly into the living room and opened the front door. A curse fell thickly from his lips at the sight of the woman crumpled across the sidewalk. He started to tighten angrily, but it made his head throb too much, and he had to let it go.
I'm sick, he thought.
The sky was gray and dead.
Great,
he thought. Another day stuck in this boarded-up rat hole. He slammed the door viciously, then winced, groaning, at the brain-stabbing noise. Outside, he heard the rest of the mirror fall out and shatter on the porch cement.
Oh, great!
His lips contorted back into a white twist of flesh. 2 cups of burning black coffee only made his stomach feel worse. He put down the cup and went into the living room.
To hell with it, he thought. I'll get drunk again.
But the liquor tasted like turpentine, and with a rasping snarl he flung the glass against the wall and stood watching the liquor run down onto the rug. Hell, I'm running out of glasses. The thought irritated him, while breath struggled in through his nostrils and out again in faltering bursts. He sank down on the couch and sat there, shaking his head slowly. It was no use. They'd beaten him. The black bastards had beaten him. That restless feeling again. The feeling as if he were expanding and the house were contracting, and any second now he'd go bursting through its frame in an explosion of wood, plaster, and brick. He got up and moved quickly to the door, his hands shaking. On the lawn, he stood sucking in great lungfuls of the wet morning air, his face turned away from the house he hated. But he hated the other houses around there, too, and he hated the pavement and the sidewalks and the lawns and everything that was on Cimarron Street. It kept building up. And suddenly he knew he had to get out of there. Cloudy day or not, he had to get out of there. He locked the front door, unlocked the garage, and dragged up the thick door on its overhead hinges. He didn't bother putting down the door. I'll be back soon, he thought. I'll just go away for a while. He backed the station wagon quickly down the driveway, jerked it around, and pressed down hard on the accelerator, heading for Compton Boulevard. He didn't know where he was going. He went around the corner doing 40 and jumped that to 65 before he'd gone another block. The car leaped forward under his foot, and he kept the accelerator on the floor, forced down by a rigid leg. His hands were like carved ice on the wheel, and his face was the face of a statue. At 89 miles an hour, he shot down the lifeless, empty boulevard, one roaring sound in the great stillness. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely, he thought, as he walked slowly across the cemetery lawn. The grass was so high that the weight of it had bent it over, and it crunched under his heavy shoes as he walked. There was no sound but that of his shoes and the now senseless singing of birds. Once I thought they sang because everything was right with the world, Robert Neville thought. I know now I was wrong. They sing because they're feeble-minded. He had raced 6 miles, the gas pedal pressed to the floor, before he'd realized where he was going. It was strange the way his mind and body had kept it secret from his consciousness. Consciously, he'd known only that he was sick and depressed and had to get away from the house. He didn't know he was going to visit Virginia. But he'd driven there directly and as fast as he could. He'd parked at the curb and entered through the rusted gate, and now his shoes were pressing and crackling through the thick grass. How long had it been since he'd come here? It must have been at least a month. He wished he'd brought flowers, but then he hadn't realized he was coming here until he was almost at the gate. His lips pressed together as an old sorrow held him again. Why couldn't he have Kathy there, too? Why had he followed so blindly, listening to those fools who set up their stupid regulations during the plague? If only she could be there, lying across from her mother. Don't start that again, he ordered himself. Drawing closer to the crypt, he stiffened as he noticed that the iron door was slightly ajar. Oh no, he thought. He broke into a run across the wet grass. If they've been at her, I'll burn down the city, he vowed. I swear to God I'll burn it to the ground if they've touched her. He flung open the door, and it clanged against the marble wall with a hollow, echoing sound. His eyes moved quickly to the marble base on which the sealed casket rested. The tension sank. He drew in breath again. It was still there, untouched. Then, as he started in, he saw the man lying in one corner of the crypt, body curled up on the cold floor. With a grunt of rage, Robert Neville rushed at the body, and grabbing the man's coat in taut fingers, he dragged him across the floor and flung him violently out onto the grass. The body rolled onto its back, the white face pointing at the sky. Robert Neville went back into the crypt, chest rising and falling with harsh movements. Then he closed his eyes and stood with his palms resting on the cover of the casket.
"I'm here," he thought. "I'm back. Remember me?"
He threw out the flowers he'd brought the time before and cleared away the few leaves that had blown in because the door had been opened. Then he sat down beside the casket and rested his forehead against its cold metal side. Silence held him in its cold and gentle hands.
"If I could die now," he thought, "peacefully, gently, without a tremor or a crying out. If I could be with her. If I could believe I would be with her."
His fingers tightened slowly, and his head sank forward on his chest.
"Virginia, take me where you are."
A tear, crystal, fell across his motionless hand. He had no idea how long he'd been there. After a while, though, even the deepest sorrow faltered, even the most penetrating despair lost its scalpel edge. The flagellant's curse, he thought, to grow inured even to the whip. He straightened up and stood. "Still alive," he thought, heart beating senselessly, veins running without point, bones and muscles and tissue all alive and functioning with no purpose at all. A moment longer he stood looking down at the casket, then he turned away with a sigh and left, closing the door behind him quietly so as not to disturb her sleep. He'd forgotten about the man. He almost tripped over him now, stepping aside with a muttered curse and starting past the body. Then, abruptly, he turned back.
"What's this?"
He looked down incredulously at the man. The man was dead. Really dead. But how could that be? The change had occurred so quickly. Yet already the man looked and smelled as though he'd been dead for days. His mind began churning with a sudden excitement. Something had killed the vampire. Something brutally effective. The heart had not been touched. No garlic had been present. And yet, it came, seemingly without effort.
Of course. The daylight.
A bolt of self-accusation struck him. To know for 5 months that they remained indoors by day, and never once to make the connection. He closed his eyes, appalled by his own stupidity.
The rays of the sun, the infrared and ultraviolet, it had to be them. But why? Damn it! Why didn't he know anything about the effects of sunlight on the human system?
Another thought.
That man had been one of the true vampires, the living dead. Would sunlight have the same effect on those who were still alive?
The first excitement he'd felt in months made him break into a run for the station wagon. As the door slammed shut beside him, he wondered if he should have taken away the dead man. Would the body attract others? Would they invade the crypt? No, they wouldn't go near the casket anyway. It was sealed with garlic. Besides, the man's blood was dead now. Again his thoughts broke off as he leaped to another conclusion.
The sun's rays must have done something to their blood.
Was it possible, then, that all things bore relations to the blood? The garlic, the cross, the mirror, the stake, daylight, the earth some of them slept in? He didn't see how, and yet... He had to do a lot of reading, a lot of research. It might be just the thing he needed. He'd been planning for a long time to do it, but lately it seemed as if he'd forgotten it altogether.
Now this new idea started the desire again. He started the car and raced up the street, turning off into a residential section.